anything sensible about it. No one. The Americans are cock-a-hoop at not having been defeated, to be sure. But the British Army surely wasn't either. All I care about is thee. And thee will be fine, she said, and laid her hand gently on his forehead. I say so. And I am as stubborn as any Scot thee cares to name, including myself.
I need to tell you something, lass.
He hadn't meant to say that, but the words felt familiar in his mouth, as though he'd said them before. Something different. She had been turning away, but paused now, looking wary.
Different? Did I tell you things while I was...
He tried to wave a hand in illustration, but even his good arm was heavy as lead. Rachel caught her upper lip between her teeth, regarding him. Who is Gilles? She asked abruptly. And what in the name of goodness did she do to thee? He blinked, startled, and yet relieved to hear the name. Yes, that was what he'd been dreaming. Oh, Jesus. The relief departed at once.
What did I see?
He asked wearily. If thee doesn't recall it, I don't wish to bring it back to thee. She knelt down by him, skirts rustling.
I remember what happened. I just want to ken what I said about it.
What happened? She repeated slowly, watching his face. In thy dreams, thee means, or... She broke off, and he saw her throat move as she swallowed.
Likely both, lass, he said, softly,
and managed to reach for her hand.
I spoke of Gilles Abernathy, though.
Thee only said Gilles, she said, and covered his hand with both of hers, holding fast. Thee was afraid, and thee called out in pain, but of course thee was in pain, so... But then it... Whatever thee saw, it... Colour rose slowly up her neck and washed her face, and with a slight relapse into the dream, he saw her for an instant as an orchid with a dusty throat into which he could plunge his... He cut that vision off and found that he was breathing fast. It seemed that thee experienced something other than pain, she said, frowning.
I did, he said, and swallowed. Can I have a bit more water?
She gave it to him, but with a fixed look indicating that she didn't mean to be distracted from his story by his physical needs. He sighed and lay back again.
It was a long time agone, Ian, and nothing to flash about now. I was taken, kidnapped, for a brief time, when I was maybe 14 or so. I stayed with a woman named Gilles Abernathy on Jamaica until my uncle found me. It wasn't a very pleasant, but I wasn't damaged either.
Rachel raised an elegant brow. He loved to watch her do that, but sometimes more than others.
There were other lads there, he said, and they were not so lucky.
For a long time afterward he'd been afraid to close his eyes at night because he saw their faces. But they faded away, little by little, and now he felt a spasm of guilt because he'd let them go into darkness. Ian, Rachel said softly, and her hand stroked his cheek. He felt the rasp of his beard stubble as she touched him, and a pleasant goose flesh ran down his jaw and shoulder. Thee needn't speak of it. I would not bring it back to thee.
It's all right, he said,
and swallowed a little easier.
I'll tell you, but later. It's an old story and one you'd then need to hear just now.
But... He stopped short, and she raised the other brow.
But what I do have to tell you, lass.
And he told her. Much of the previous 2 days' events were still a blur, but he recalled vividly the two Abenaki who had hunted him, and what he'd finally done in the British camp. She was silent for so long that he began to wonder whether he'd really waked and had this conversation, or was still dreaming.
Rachel,
he said, shifting uneasily on his bed of prickly hay. The door of the byre was open and there was light enough, but he couldn't read her face at all. Her gaze rested on his own face, though, hazel-eyed and distant, as though she were looking through him. He was afraid she was.
He could hear Hewan the smith outside walking to and fro and making clanking sounds, pausing to apostrophize some uncooperative implement in coarse terms. He could hear his own heart beating too, an uncomfortable jerky thump. Finally, a shiver went over Rachel as though she shook herself awake, and she put a hand on his forehead, smoothing back his hair as she looked into his eyes, her own now soft and fathomless. Her thumb came down and traced the tattooed line across his cheekbones, very slowly. "I think we can't wait any longer to be married, Ian," she said softly. "I will not have thee face such things alone. These are bad times, and we must be together." He closed his eyes and all the air went out of him. When he drew breath again, it tasted of peace. "When?" he whispered. "As soon as thee can walk without help," she said, and kissed him, lightly as a falling leaf. Chapter 93. The House on Chestnut Street. The house was occupied. There was smoke drifting from the west chimney. The door was locked, though, and bolted to boot. "I wonder what happened to the old door," John said to Hal, trying the knob again just in case. "It used to be green. If you knock on this one, you might conceivably get someone to come out and tell you," Hal suggested. They weren't in uniform, but Hal was noticeably on edge and had been since their call on General Arnold. The General had been understandably reserved, but civil, and after reading Fraser's letter over 3 or 4 times, had agreed to give them passes to remain in the city and to make such inquiries as they saw fit. "With the understanding," Arnold had said, a flash of his reputed arrogance showing through the facade of governorship, "that if I hear of anything untoward, I'll have you both arrested and ridden out of the city on a rail." "On a what?" Hal had said incredulously, he having not encountered this peculiarly American method of making guests feel unwelcome. "A rail," Arnold had repeated, smiling genially. "Long piece of wood? Used for fences, I believe." Hal had turned to John, one eyebrow raised, as though inviting him to translate the speech of some Hottentot randomly encountered. John sighed internally, but did so. "An undesirable person is mounted on the object in question," he said, straddling it. "Whereupon a party of men lift either end and set off through the streets with it, decanting the rider outside the city. I believe tar and feathers are sometimes applied as a preliminary gesture, though the physical effects of the rail are generally presumed to be sufficient." "Flatten your ball sack like a horse stepped on it," Arnold said, still smiling. "Won't do your arse any good either." "I should imagine not," Hal said politely. His colour was somewhat higher than usual, but he gave no other indication of offence, which Grey thought a reasonable indication, not that he needed one, of the importance of their mission to Hal. The sound of the bolt grating free interrupted his recollection. The door swung open, revealing his housekeeper and cook, Mrs. Fig, fowling piece in hand. "Lord John," she exclaimed, dropping the gun with a clatter. "Well, yes," he said, stepping in and picking it up. He smiled, feeling affection well up in his bosom at sight of her, substantial, tidy, and beribboned, as always. "It's very good to see you again, Mrs. Fig. Allow me to make you acquainted with my brother, the..." "We've met," Hal said, a wry edge to his voice. "How do you do, madam?"
"Better than your grace, by the looks of you," Mrs. Fig replied, narrowing her eyes at him. "Still breathing, though, I see." She sounded as though this was not entirely a desirable state of affairs, but Hal smiled broadly at her.
"Did you manage to bury the silver in time?" he asked.
"Certainly," she replied with dignity, and turning to John, asked, "You come to get it, my lord? I can have it dug up right smart."
"Perhaps not just yet," John said.
He looked round, noting the missing banister railing on the upper landing, the smudged and pockmarked wall by the staircase, and...
"What's happened to the chandelier?"
Mrs. Fig sighed and shook her head darkly.
"That'd be Master William," she said.
How is he, my lord?
I'm afraid I don't know, Mrs. Fig. I was in some hopes that he might have been here, but I gather not.
She looked disturbed at this.
No, sir.
We've not seen him since, well, since the day you went away yourself. She looked hard at him, taking in everything from the cropped hair to the fading bruises and the undistinguished suit, shook her head and sighed, but then straightened her broad shoulders, determined to be cheerful.
And glad we are to see you, sir.
And your grace, she added, as a definite afterthought.
Go sit yourselves down and I'll have you up a nice cup of tea in 2 minutes.
You have tea? Hal said, brightening.
We buried the tea chest first thing, she informed him. But I just brought in a brick for Miss Dotty, so...
Dotty's here?
To be sure, said Mrs. Fig, pleased to be the bearer of good news. I'll just step out to the kitchen and fetch her.
This proved to be unnecessary, as the sound of the back door opening betokened Dotty's entrance, carrying an apron full of lumpy objects. These proved to be vegetable marrows from the kitchen garden, which cascaded over the floor in a bouncing flood of green and yellow as she let go the apron in order to leap at her father and embrace him.
Papa!
For an instant, Hal's face changed entirely, soft with love, and Grey was surprised and disconcerted to feel tears come to his own eyes. He turned away, blinking, and wandered over to the sideboard, meaning to give them a private moment. The silver tea service was gone, of course, but his meissen porcelain plates were in their accustomed spots on the plate rail. He touched the cool, gilt-ribboned border of one, feeling oddly disembodied. And his place shall know him no more. But Dotty was talking now to both of them. Grey turned round to her, smiling.
I'm so glad you're both safe and both here.
Her cheeks were flushed, her eyes sparkling, and Grey's heart misgave him at the knowledge that this state of happiness would be quenched within the next minute, as soon as Hal told her the reason for their presence. Before any such doom could fall, though, Dotty had seized the reins of the conversation and driven it off in another direction entirely.
Since you are here, Uncle John, could we possibly use your house? For the wedding, I mean. Please, please.
The wedding? Hal disengaged himself gently and cleared his throat. Your wedding?
Of course I mean my wedding, Papa. Don't be silly.
She beamed at her uncle, placing a coquettish hand on his sleeve.
May we, Uncle John? We cannot be married in a meeting house, but we must have witnesses for a proper marriage of friends. And really, I'm sure Papa wouldn't want to see me married in the public room of a tavern. Would you? She appealed, turning to Hal, whose expression had reverted to its earlier guardedness.
Well, certainly you may, my dear, John said, glancing round his parlour.
Assuming that I retain possession of this place long enough for the marriage to take place. When is the ceremony to be, and how many witnesses will we need to accommodate?
She hesitated, tapping a fingernail against her teeth. I'm not really sure. There will be some of the conscientious friends, who, like Denny, have been put out of meeting for joining the Continental Army. And some friends in the lower case, meaning no disrespect, if any are left in Philadelphia, and family?
She hesitated again, looking at her father sideways from under her lashes. John suppressed a smile. Hal closed his eyes and sighed deeply.
Yes, I'll come to your wedding, he said, opening them with resignation. And so will Henry, if I have to drag him by the scruff of the neck. I suppose Mrs. Woodcock must be invited too, he added, with a marked lack of enthusiasm. But of course, Adam, and Ben.
John thought for a moment that he must tell her now, but his brother's lips closed, firmed with determination. He didn't look at John, but John caught the, not now for God's sake, let her be happy for a bit longer, as clearly as if it had been spoken aloud.
No, that's too bad, Dotty said with regret,
and met her father's eyes directly.
I'm sorry about Mama. I did write to her, though.
Did you, sweetheart?
Hal said,
sounding almost normal.
That was thoughtful.
He tilted his head at her, though, eyes narrowing a bit.
What else?
Oh.
Her colour, which had returned to normal, rose again, and she began absently pleating her apron with one hand.
Well, did you know that Rachel, Denzel's sister, is affianced to Ian Murray? That's Mr. James... Oh, no. No, we don't use Mr. Sorry. He's the nephew of James Fraser. You know...
I do know, Hal said, in a tone cutting off further amendation. Who he is, I mean. What are you saying, Dotty? Without embroidery, if you please.
She sniffed at him, but didn't appear to be discomposed in the least. Well, then, Rachel and Ian wish to be married as soon as they can, and so do Denny and I. As all the witnesses will be present, why not have both marriages at the same time?
This time Hal did look at John, who returned the look somewhat taken aback.
Well, I suppose that would mean additional guests, including the aforementioned Mr. Fraser. I'm sure you will excuse my using his title, my dear. I'm accustomed to such social excesses.
Well, yes. Rachel says that Mrs. Fraser is enough recovered that they will return to Philadelphia tomorrow or next day. And then, of course, there's Fergus and his wife Masali, and perhaps the children. And I don't know if there are other friends who... I don't think Ian has any Mohawk relations nearby, but...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
John turned and began counting the small gilt chairs that stood rigidly to attention beneath the wainscoting.
I think we shall be somewhat cramped, Dotty, but if...
Mrs. Fig cleared her throat.
The sound was sufficiently impressive that everyone else stopped talking and looked at her.
"Beg pardon, gentlemen," she said,
and a faint flush was visible on her round face.
"I don't mean to be forward or presuming, but so happens that I mentioned to the Reverend Fig about Miss Dotty and friend Denzel needing a place to be married in."
She cleared her throat, the blush growing deeper beneath her dark skin so that she bore a surprising resemblance to a just-fired cannonball, Grey thought, charmed by the notion.
"And, well, the long and the short of it, ma'am and gentlemen, is that the Reverend and his congregation would be pleased for you to consider being married in the new church building, you having been so kind as to contribute to it. 'Tain't always fancy, mind, but..."
"Mrs. Fig, you are a marvel."
Grey clasped her hands in his, an attention that flustered her to the point of speechlessness. Seeing this, he let go, though this allowed Dotty to swoop in and kiss the housekeeper, exclaiming in gratitude.
That was all right, but when Hal took Mrs. Fig by the hand and kissed it, the poor lady was reduced nearly to the point of suffocation, and snatching back her hand, retreated in haste, muttering disjointedly about tea, and narrowly avoiding tripping on a marrow.
"Is it all right to be married in a church?"
Hal asked Dotty, once Mrs. Fig had retired to a safe distance.
"It's not like Jews, is it? We needn't be circumcised in order to attend. Because if so, I think your guest list may be substantially reduced."
"Oh, I'm sure it's not,"
Dotty began rather vaguely, but her attention was distracted by something seen through the front window.
"Goodness, is that..."
Not bothering to complete her thought, she flew to the unbolted door and yanked it open, revealing a startled William on the stoop.
"Dotty," he said, "what?"
And then caught sight of John and Hal. William's face underwent a lightning shift that made a frisson run straight down John's back to his tailbone. He'd seen that exact expression on Jamie Fraser's face 100 times at least, but had never before seen it on William's. It was the look of a man who doesn't like his immediate prospects one bit, but who feels himself entirely capable of dealing with them. William stepped inside, repelling by force of will Dotty's abortive attempt to embrace him. He removed his hat and bowed to Dotty, then punctiliously to John and Hal.
"Your servant, ma'am."
"Sirs."
Hal snorted, looking his nephew over from head to toe. William was dressed much as John and Hal were, in ordinary clothes,
though clothes of good cut and quality, John observed. Clearly his own.
And where the devil have you been for the last 3 days, may I ask?
No, you mayn't, William replied briefly.
Why are you here?
Looking for you, for one thing, John replied equably before Hal could stick his oar in again.
He'd put the fowling piece on the mantel, easily within Hal's reach, but was reasonably sure it wasn't loaded.
And for Captain Richardson for another. Have you seen him recently?
William's expression of surprise made John heave an internal sigh of relief.
No, I haven't.
William glanced shrewdly from one man to the other.
Is that what you were doing at Arnold's headquarters? Looking for Richardson?
Yes, John answered, surprised.
How did you...
Oh.
You were watching the place.
He smiled.
I did wonder how you managed to appear here so fortuitously. You followed us from General Arnold's.
William nodded, and stretching out a long arm, drew out one of the chairs from the wall.
I did.
Sit down. Things need to be said.
That sounds rather ominous, Dotty murmured. Perhaps I'd best fetch the brandy.
Please do, Dotty, John said. Tell Mrs. Fig we want the 57, if you would. If it isn't buried, I mean.
I think everything of an alcoholic nature is in the well, actually. I'll fetch it.
Mrs. Fig herself arrived at this point with a rattling tea tray, apologizing for the lowly earthenware pot in which the beverage was brewing, and within a few moments everyone was provided with a steaming cup and a small glass of the 57.
Thank you, sweetheart, Hal said, accepting a glass from Dotty, then added pointedly, You needn't stay.
I'd rather you did, Dotty, William said quietly, but with an overt stare at Hal. There are things you ought to know, I think.
With no more than a brief glance at her father, Dotty, who had been picking up the scattered squash, sat down on the ottoman opposite her cousin.
Tell me then, she said simply.
Nothing out of the way, he assured her with an assumption of casualness. I recently discovered that I am the natural son of one James Fraser who...
Oh, she said, and looked at him with renewed interest. I did think General Fraser reminded me of someone. Of course, that's it. Goodness, Willie, you do look like him.
William looked flabbergasted, but quickly pulled himself together.
He's a general? He asked Hal.
He was, Hal said. He's resigned his commission.
William made a small, humourless noise.
Has he? Well, so have I.
After a long, silent moment, John placed his cup carefully on its saucer with a small clink.
Why?
He asked mildly, at the same moment that Hal, frowning, said,
Can you do such a thing while technically a prisoner of war?
I don't know, William said tersely, and evidently in answer to both questions.
But I've done it. Now, as to Captain Richardson,
and he recounted his astonishing encounter with Dennis Randall Isaacs on the road.
Or rather, Dennis Randall, as he now calls himself. Evidently his stepfather's a Jew, and he wishes to avoid the association.
Sensible, Hal said briefly.
I don't know him. What else do you know about him, William? What's his connection with Richardson?
I haven't the faintest idea, William said, and draining his cup, reached for the pot and poured another.
There is one, obviously, and prior to this I would have assumed that Randall perhaps worked with or for Richardson.
Perhaps he still does, John suggested, a slight edge in his voice.
He'd been a spy himself for some years, and was disinclined to take things said by known intelligences at face value. That seemed to take William aback for a moment. But he nodded reluctantly.
All right, he conceded. But tell me, why the devil are you two interested in Richardson?
They told him. At the conclusion, Hal was perched anxiously on the ottoman beside Dotty, an arm round her shaking shoulders. She was weeping silently, and he was dabbing at her face with his handkerchief, this now a grubby rag following its service as a flag of truce.
I don't believe it, he was repeating doggedly for the sixth or seventh time.
Do you hear me, darling? I do not believe it, and I won't have you believe it either.
No, she said obediently. No, I won't. Oh, Ben.
In some hopes of distracting her, John turned back to William.
And what business brought you to Philadelphia, may I ask? You can't have come in search of Captain Richardson, because when you left camp you didn't know he'd disappeared.
I came on a personal matter, William said, in a tone suggesting that the matter was still personal and was going to remain that way. But also...
He pressed his lips together for a moment, and again John had that odd sense of dislocation, seeing Jamie Fraser.
I was going to leave this here for you, in case you came back to the city. Or ask Mrs. Fig to send it to New York if...
His voice trailed away as he pulled a letter from the breast of his dark blue coat.
But I needn't now, he concluded firmly, and put it away again. It's only saying what I've already told you.
A slight flush touched his cheekbones, though, and he avoided John's eye, turning instead to Hal.
I'll go and find out about Ben, he said simply. I'm not a soldier any longer. There's no danger of my being taken up as a spy. And I can travel much more easily than you can.
Oh, William.
Dottie took the handkerchief from her father and blew her nose with a small, ladylike honk. She looked at him with brimming eyes.
Will you? Really? Oh, thank you.
That was not, of course, the end of it. But it was no revelation to Grey that William possessed a stubbornness so obviously derived from his natural father that no one but Hal would even have thought of arguing with him. And even Hal didn't argue long. In due course, William rose to go.
Give Mrs. Fig my love, please, he said to John.
And with a small bow to Dottie,
goodbye, cousin.
John followed him to the door to let him out, but at the threshold put a hand on his sleeve.
Willie, he said softly, give me the letter.
For the first time, William looked a little less than certain. He put his hand to his breast, but left it there, hesitant.
I won't read it, unless you don't come back. But if you don't, I want it to keep.
William drew breath, nodded, and reaching into his coat, removed a sealed cover and handed it over. Grey saw that it had been sealed with a thick daub of candle wax, and that William hadn't used his signet, preferring instead to stamp it with his thumbprint, firm in the hot wax.
Thank you, he said, through the lump in his throat. Godspeed, son.
Chapter 94. The Sense of the Meeting. The Methodist Church was a modest wooden building with plain glass windows, and while it did have an altar, might otherwise easily have passed as a Quaker meeting house, bar three framed cross-stitched samplers bearing Bible verses that hung on one wall. I heard Rachel let out her breath as she stopped just inside, looking around.
No flowers? Mrs. Fig had said the day before, scandalized. I understand plain, but God made flowers.
A friend's meeting house would not have flowers, Rachel had said, smiling. We think them somewhat pagan and a distraction to worship. But we are thy guests, and surely a guest must not tell his host how to keep his own house.
Mrs. Fig blinked at the word pagan, but then made a low humming noise, and settled back into benignity.
Well and good, then, she said. His lordship has three good rose bushes and their sunflowers in every yard in town. Lots of honeysuckle, too, she added thoughtfully.
There was. Everyone planted honeysuckle by the privy. As a nod to the Quaker's sensibilities, though, there was only one vase of flowers, a very plain glass vase, between the two wooden benches that had been set at the front of the room, and the faint perfume of honeysuckle and pink cabbage roses mingled with a turpentine smell of hot pine boards, and the pungent scents of fairly clean but very hot people. Rachel and I stepped outside again, joining the rest of what I supposed might be called the wedding party, in the shade under a big lime tree. People were still arriving in ones and twos, and I caught a good many curious looks directed at us, though these were not aimed at the two brides.
"You are being married in that?"
Hal said, eyeing Dottie's Sunday best gown of soft grey muslin with a white fichu and a bow at the back of the waist. Dottie raised one smooth blonde brow at him.
"Ha!" she said. "Mummy told me what she wore when you married her in a tavern in Amsterdam, and what your first wedding was like. Diamonds and white lace in St. James's Church didn't help all that much, did they?"
"Dorothea," Denzel said mildly. "Don't savage thy father. He has enough to bear."
Hal, who had flushed at Dottie's remarks, went somewhat redder at Denny's, and breathed in a menacing rasp, but didn't say anything further. Hal and John were both wearing full dress uniform, and far outshone the two brides in splendour. I thought it rather a pity that Hal wouldn't get to walk Dottie down the aisle, but he had merely inhaled deeply when the form of the marriage was outlined to him, and said, after being elbowed sharply in the ribs by his brother, that he was honoured to witness the event. Jamie, by contrast, didn't wear uniform, but his appearance in full Highland dress made Mrs. Fig's eyes bulge, and not only hers.
"Sweet Shepherd of Judea," she muttered to me, "is that man wearing a woolen petticoat? And what sort of pattern is that cloth? Enough to burn the eyes out of your head."
"They call it a philibeg," I told her, in the native language. "In English, it's usually called a kilt, and the pattern is his family tartan." She eyed him for a long moment, the colour rising slowly in her cheeks. She turned to me with her mouth open to ask a question, then thought better and shut it firmly. "No," I said, laughing.
"He isn't."
She snorted.
"Either way, he's like to die of the heat," she predicted, "and so are those two gamecocks."
She nodded at John and Hal, glorious and sweating in crimson and gold lace. Henry had also come in uniform, wearing his more modest lieutenant's apparel. He squired Mercy Woodcock on his arm, and gave his father a stare, daring him to say anything.
"Poor Hal," I murmured to Jamie. "His children are rather a trial to him."
"Aye, whose aunt?" he replied. "All right, Sassenach. You look pale. Had you not best go in and sit down?"
"No, I'm quite all right," I assured him. "I just am pale after a month indoors.
It's good to be in the fresh air."
I had a stick, as well as Jamie, to lean on, but was feeling quite well, bar a slight stitch in my side, and was enjoying the sensations of mobility, if not the sensation of wearing stays and petticoats in hot weather again. It was going to be even hotter, sitting packed together once the meeting began. The Reverend Mr. Fig's congregation was there, of course, it being their church, and the benches were filled with bodies. The church had no bell, but a few blocks away, the bell of St. Peter's began to toll the hour. It was time, and Jamie, I, and the Grey brothers made our way inside and found our places. The air hummed with murmured conversation and curiosity, the more so were the British uniforms, and Jamie's plaid, though both he and the Greys had left their swords at home, in deference to the Friends' meeting. Both curiosity and conversation rose to a much higher pitch when Ian walked in. He wore a new shirt, white calico printed with blue and purple tulips, his buckskins and breech clout, moccasins, and an armlet made of blue and white wampum shells, which I was reasonably sure that his Mohawk wife, works with her hands, had made for him.
"And here, of course, is the best man,"
I heard John whisper to Hal. Rollo stalked in at Ian's heel, disregarding the further stir he caused. Ian sat down quietly on one of the two benches that had been set at the front of the church, facing the congregation, and Rollo sat at his feet, scratched himself idly, then collapsed and lay panting gently, surveying the crowd with a yellow stare of lazy estimation, as though judging them for eventual edibility. Denzel came in looking a little pale, but walked up,
and sat down on the bench beside Ian. He smiled at the congregation, most of whom murmured and smiled back. Denny wore his best suit. He owned two. A decent navy broadcloth with pewter buttons, and while he was both shorter and less ornamental than Ian, did not by any means disappear beside his outlandish brother-in-law-to-be.
"You're not going to be sick, lass,"
Jamie said to Rachel. She and Dotty had come in, but hovered near the wall. Rachel's hands were clenched in the fabric of her skirt. She was white as a sheet, but her eyes glowed. They were fastened on Ian, who was looking at no one but her, his own heart in his eyes.
"No," she whispered. "Come with me, Dotty."
She held out a hand, and the two girls walked together to the other bench and sat down. Dotty's colour was high, and so was her head. Rachel folded her hands in her lap and resumed looking at Ian. I felt Jamie sigh a little and relax. On Jamie's far side, Jenny craned to see round him, then smiled with gratification. She'd made Rachel's dress herself, for after the exigencies of recent months, Rachel owned nothing that wasn't near rags. And while Jenny was generally in favour of modesty in dress, she knew her way around a bust line. The dress was a pale green chintz with a small pattern of dark green curling vines and fitted like a glove. With her dark brown hair shining loose on her shoulders and hazel eyes huge in her face, Rachel looked like some denizen of the forest, perhaps a tree nymph. I was about to share this fancy with Jamie when the Reverend Mr. Fig walked up to the front of the church, turned and smiled at the congregation.
"Blessings to you all this day, brothers and sisters," he said, and was answered by a genial rumble of "Blessings to you, brother," and discreet amens. "Well, now."
He glanced from Ian and Denny to the girls, then back to the congregation.
"We're gathered here for a wedding today, but the ladies and gentlemen being married belong to the Society of Friends, so it will be a Quaker wedding, and that's maybe a little different from ones you've seen before. So I take the liberty of telling you how it goes."
A little hum of interest and speculation which he quieted with one hand. Mr. Fig was small and dapper in black suit and high white stock, but had immense presence, and every ear was tuned attentively to his explanations.
"We have the honour to host this meeting, for that's what the friends call their worship, and for them a wedding is just a normal part of meeting. There's no priest or minister involved. The lady and the gentleman just marry each other when they feel like it's the right time."
That caused a ripple of surprise, perhaps a little disapproval, and I could see the colour rise in Dotty's cheeks. Mr. Fig turned to smile at the girls, then back to his congregation.
"I think perhaps one of our Quaker friends might tell us a little bit about their notion of meeting, as I'm sure they know more about it than I do."
He turned expectantly toward Denzel Hunter, but it was Rachel who rose to her feet. Mr. Fig didn't see her, and started with surprise when she spoke behind him, making everyone laugh.
"Good morning," she said,
soft-spoken but clear, when the laughter had died down.
"I thank you all for your presence here, for Christ said, 'Wherever two or more of you are gathered in my name, there am I.' And that is all the essence of a meeting of friends, that Christ may make his presence known among us and within us."
She spread her hands a little. "So we gather and we listen, both to one another and to the light within us. When a person is moved of the Spirit to speak, he or she does speak."
"Or sing if he likes," Dotty put in, dimpling at John.
"Or sing," Rachel agreed, smiling. "But we do not fear silence, for often God speaks loudest in the quiet of our hearts."
And with that, she sat down again, composed. A moment of shuffling and blinking among the crowd was succeeded, in fact, by an expectant silence. This broken by Denny, who rose deliberately and said,
"I am moved to tell you how grateful I am for your gracious use of us. For I was put out of meeting, and my sister with me, for my stated intent to join the Continental Army.
and for the same reason, we are not welcome as members of Philadelphia meeting. He glanced at Rachel, light glinting from his spectacles.
This is a grievous thing to a friend, he said quietly, for our meeting is where our lives and souls abide. And when friends marry, the whole of their meeting must approve and witness the marriage, for the community itself will support the marriage.
I have deprived my sister of this approval and support, and I beg she will forgive me.
Rachel gave an unladylike snort. Thee followed thy conscience, and if I hadn't thought thee right, I would have said so.
It was my responsibility to take care of thee.
Thee has taken care of me, Rachel said. Do I look malnourished? Am I naked?
A ripple of amusement ran through the congregation, but neither of the hunters was noticing. I took thee from thy home, and from the meeting that cared for thee, and obliged thee to follow me into violence, into an army full of violent men.
That would be me, I expect,
Ian interrupted, clearing his throat.
He looked at Mr. Fig, who seemed somewhat stunned, then at the rapt assemblage on the benches.
I'm no friend myself, you ken. I'm a Highlander and a Mohawk, and they dinna come much more violent than that. By rights, I shouldna wed Rachel, and her brother shouldna let me.
I would like to see him stop me,
said Rachel, sitting bolt upright with her fists curled on her knees.
Or thee either, Ian Murray.
Dottie appeared to be finding the conversation amusing. I could see her struggling not to laugh. And glancing sideways along the bench in front of me, I could see precisely the same expression on her father's face.
Well, it's on my account that you couldn't be wed in a proper Quaker meeting, Ian protested. No more than on mine, Denny said, grimacing. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa,
Jamie murmured in my ear.
Do you think I should say it's all my fault, for leaving Ian with the Indians and being a bad example to him?
Only if the spirit moves you, I said, not taking my eyes off the show. Personally, I'd advise you and the spirit to stay out of it.
Mrs. Fig was not disposed to stay out of it. She cleared her throat loudly.
Now, pardon me for interrupting, but from what I understand, you friends think a woman's equal to a man. Is that right?
It is, Rachel and Dottie said firmly together, and everyone laughed.
Mrs. Fig flushed like a ripe black plum, but kept her composure.
Well then, she said, if these ladies want to marry with you gentlemen, why do you think you got any business trying to talk them out of it? Have you maybe got your own reservations about the matter?
A distinctly feminine murmur of approval came from the congregation, and Denny, who was still standing, seemed to be struggling for his own composure.
Does he have a cock?
Came a French-accented whisper from behind me, and an unhinged giggle from Massali in response.
You can't get married without a cock.
This reminiscence of Fergus and Massali's unorthodox wedding on a Caribbean beach made me stuff my lace handkerchief into my mouth. Jamie shook with suppressed laughter.
I do have reservations, Denzel said, taking a deep breath.
Though not, he added hastily, with a glance at Dottie, regarding my desire to wed Dorothea, or the honour of my intentions toward her. My reservations, and perhaps friend Ian's, though I must not speak for him, lie entirely the other way. That is, we, perhaps, feel that we must lay bare our failings and limitations as husbands.
And for the first time he too blushed.
That Dorothea and Rachel may come to a proper,
That they know what they may be getting into? Mrs. Fig finished for him.
Well, that's a fine sentiment, Dr. Hunter.
Friend, he murmured.
Friend, Hunter, she said with a minimal roll of the eyes. But I tell you two things. One, your young lady probably knows more about you than you do.
More laughter.
And two, speaking as a woman with some experience, I can tell you that nobody knows what being married's going to be like until you find yourself in the midst of it.
She sat down with an air of finality to a hum of approbation.
There was a certain amount of glancing to and fro, and a sense of movement on the left side of the church, where several men sat together. I had seen them come in, with women who were plainly their wives. The women had separated, though, and gone to sit on the right side of the church, which made me think that they might be Quakers, though there was nothing in their dress that differentiated them from the other workmen and merchants in the congregation. I could see them come to some sort of silent consensus now, and one of them rose.
"I am William Sprocket," he said formally, and cleared his throat. "We have come to speak in support of Friend Hunter, for we also are friends, who have followed the dictates of our conscience to involvement with rebellion and other matters that a friend would normally seek to avoid. And in consequence, have been read out of meeting."
He paused, brow furrowed, evidently not sure how to go on. A small woman in yellow rose on the other side and spoke clearly.
"What my husband seeks to say, friends, is that a man who would not do as his inner light tells him to, is no man. And that while a man of conscience can be mighty inconvenient at times, it don't make him a bad husband."
She smiled at Mr. Sprocket and sat down.
"Yes," said Mr. Sprocket gratefully. "As my wife is kind enough to say, going to fight don't unfit us for marriage. So we've all come."
He swept a broad hand around him, indicating his companions and the wives across the aisle.
"To approve and witness thy marriage, Friend Hunter."
"And we will support thy marriage, Dorothea,"
Mrs. Sprocket put in, with a bob of her head.
"And thine, Rachel."
Denny Hunter had remained standing while all this colloquy was going on.
"I thank you, friends," he said,
and sat down abruptly, followed more slowly by the Sprockets. A hush fell upon the room, and for a little while there was no sound but the remote noise of the streets outside. Here and there a cough, the clearing of a throat, but overall, silence. Jamie laid a hand on mine, and my fingers turned to intertwine with his.
I could feel his pulse in my own fingertips,
the solid bones of knuckle and phalanges. His right hand, battered and marked with the scars of sacrifice and labour. Marked also with the signs of my love, the crude repairs done in pain and desperation. Blood of my blood, bone of my bone. I wondered whether people who are unhappily married think of their own nuptials when they witness a wedding. I thought that those who are happy always do. Jenny's head was bowed, her face calm and inward, but peaceful. Did she think now of Ian and her wedding day? She did. Her head turned a little to one side. She laid a hand lightly on the bench and smiled at the ghost who sat by her side. Hal and John sat on the bench in front of us, a little to the side, so I could catch glimpses of their faces, so much alike, and yet so different. Both of them had been married twice. It was a slight shock, in fact, to recall that John's second marriage had been to me, for he felt entirely separate from me now, our brief partnership seeming so removed in time as almost to be unreal. And then there was Frank. Frank, John, Jamie. Sincerity of intention wasn't always enough, I thought, looking at the young people on the benches at the front of the church. None of them now looking at one another, but staring at their folded hands, the floor, or sitting with closed eyes. Perhaps realizing that, as Mrs. Fig had said, a marriage is made not in ritual or in words, but in the living of it. A movement pulled me out of my thoughts. Denny had risen to his feet and held out a hand to Dotty, who rose as though mesmerized, and, reaching out, clasped both his hands in hers, hanging on for dear life.
"Does he feel the sense of the meeting clear, Dorothea?"
he asked softly, and at her nod spoke.
"In the presence of the Lord, and before these our friends, I take thee, Dorothea, to be my wife, promising, with divine assistance, to be unto thee a loving and faithful husband, so long as we both shall live."
Her voice was low, but clearly audible, as, face shining, she replied,
"In the presence of the Lord, and before these our friends, I take thee, Denzel, to be my husband, promising, with divine assistance, to be unto thee a loving and faithful wife, so long as we both shall live."
I heard Hal catch his breath in what sounded like a sob, and then the church burst into applause. Denny looked startled at this, but then broke into a brilliant smile, and led Dotty, beaming on his arm, out through the congregation to the back of the church, where they sat close together on the last bench. People murmured and sighed, smiling, and the church gradually quieted, but not to its former sense of contemplation. There was now a vibrant sense of expectation, tinged perhaps with a little anxiety, as attention focused on Ian and Rachel, no longer looking at each other, but down at the floor. Ian took a breath audible to the back benches, raised his head, and taking the knife from his belt, laid it on the bench beside him.
"Aye. Well, Rachel Kenns, I was once married to a woman of the Wolf Clan, of the Cayan Cahaca. And the Mohawk way of marriage is maybe none so different from the way friends do it. We sat beside each other, before the people. And our parents, they'd adopted me, Ken, spoke for us, saying what they kent of us, and that we were of good character.
So far as they knew," he added apologetically, and there was a breath of laughter.
"The lass I was to wed had a basket on her lap, filled with fruit and vegetables and other bits of food, and she said to me that she promised to feed me from her fields and care for me, and I..."
He swallowed, and reaching out laid a hand on his knife.
"I had a knife, and a bow, and the skins of some otters I'd taken, and I promised to hunt for her, and keep her warm with my furs. And the people all agreed that we should be married, and so we were."
He stopped, biting his lip, then cleared his throat and went on.
"But the Mohawk dinna take each other for as long as they live, but only for as long as the woman wishes. My wife chose to part with me, not because I hurt or mistreated her, but for other reasons."
He cleared his throat again, and his hand went to the wampum armlet round his biceps.
"My wife was called Works with Her Hands, and she made this for me as a love token."
Long brown fingers fumbled with the strings, and the strip of woven shells came loose, slithering into his hand.
"Now I lay it down as witness that I come here as a free man, that my life and my heart are once more mine to give. And I hope I may be allowed now to give them forever."
The blue and white shells made a soft clicking noise as he laid them on the bench. He let his fingers rest on them for a moment, then took his hand away. I could hear Hal's breathing, steady now, but with a faint rasp, and Jamie's, thick in his throat. I could feel all sorts of things moving like wraiths in the thick, still air of the church. Sentiment, sympathy, doubt, apprehension.
Rollo growled very softly in his throat and fell silent, yellow-eyed and watchful at his master's feet.
We waited. Jamie's hand twitched in mine, and I looked up at him. He was looking at Ian, intent, his lips pressed tight, and I knew he was wondering whether to stand up and speak on Ian's behalf, to assure the congregation and Rachel of Ian's character and virtue. He caught my glance, though, shook his head very slightly, and nodded toward the front. It was Rachel's part to speak, if she would. Rachel sat still as stone, face bleached as bone, and her eyes on Ian, burning. But she said nothing. Neither did she move, but something moved in her. I could see the knowledge of it cross her face, and somehow her body changed, straightening and settling. She was listening. We all listened with her, and the silence kindled slowly into light. There was a faint throb in the air then, not quite a sound, and people began to look up, called from the silence. A blur appeared between the benches at the front, and a hummingbird materialized, drawn through the open window, a tiny blur of green and scarlet hovering beside the coral trumpets of the native honeysuckle. A sigh came from the heart of the church, and the sense of the meeting was made clear. Ian rose, and Rachel came to meet him. A coda in 3-2 time. Denzel and Dorothea. It was the best party that Dorothea Jacqueline Benedicta Gray had ever attended. She had danced with earls and viscounts in the most beautiful ballrooms in London, eaten everything from gilded peacock to trout stuffed with shrimp, and riding on an artful sea of aspic, with a triton carved of ice brandishing his spear over all. And she'd done these things in gowns so splendid that men blinked when she hove into view. Her new husband didn't blink. He stared at her so intently through his steel-rimmed spectacles that she thought she could feel his gaze on her skin from across the room and right through her dove-grey dress. And she thought she might burst with happiness, exploding in bits all over the tap room of the White Camel Tavern. Not that anyone would notice if she did. There were so many people crammed into the room, drinking, talking, drinking, singing, and drinking, that a spare gallbladder or kidney underfoot would pass without notice. Just possibly, she thought, one or two whole people might pass without notice too, right out of this lovely party. She reached Denzel with some difficulty, there being a great many well-wishers between them, but as she approached him, he stretched out a hand and seized hers, and an instant later they were outside in the night air, laughing like loons, and kissing each other in the shadows of the Anabaptist meeting house that stood next door to the tavern. "Will he come home now, Dorothea?" Denny said, pausing for a momentary breath. "Is he ready?" She didn't let go of him, but moved closer, dislodging his glasses and enjoying the scent of his shaving soap and the starch in his linen, and the scent of him underneath.
"Are we truly married now?" she whispered. "I am thy wife."
"We are. Thee is," he said, his voice slightly husky. "And I am thy husband." She thought he'd meant to speak solemnly, but such an uncontainable smile of joy spread across his face at the speaking that she laughed out loud.
"We didn't say one flesh in our vows," she said, stepping back but keeping hold of his hand. "But does thee think that principle obtains, generally speaking?"
He settled his glasses more firmly on his nose and looked at her with intense concentration and shining eyes, and, with one finger of his free hand, touched her breast.
"I'm counting on it, Dorothea."
She'd been in his rooms before, but first as a guest and then as an assistant, coming up to pack a basket with bandages and ointments before accompanying him to some professional call. It was quite different now. He'd opened all the windows earlier and left them so, careless of flying insects and the butcher's shop down the street. The second floor of the building would have been suffocating after the day's heat, but with the gentle night breeze coming through, the air was like warm milk, soft and liquid on the skin, and the meaty smells of the butcher's shop were now overborne by the night perfume of the gardens at Bingham House, 2 streets over. All trace of his profession had been cleared away, and the light of the candle he lit shone serenely on a plainly furnished but comfortable room. 2 small wing chairs sat beside the hearth, a single book on the table between them, and through the open door, a bed, fresh made with a smooth counterpane and plump white pillows, beckoned enticingly. The blood still thrummed through her body like wine, though she'd had very little to drink. Still, she felt unaccountably shy, and stood for a moment just inside the door, as though waiting to be invited in. Denny lit 2 more candles, and, turning, saw her standing there.
"Come," he said softly,
stretching out a hand to her, and she did. They kissed lingeringly, hands roaming slowly, clothes beginning to loosen. Her hand drifted casually down and touched him through his breeches. He drew breath and would have said something, but wasn't quick enough. "One flesh," she reminded him, smiling, and cupped her hand. "I want to see thy half of it."
"Thee has seen such things before," Denny said. "I know thee has. Thee has brothers, for one thing, and in the course of treating wounded men."
He was lying naked on the bed, and so was she, fondling the object in question, which seemed to be enjoying the attention immensely. His fingers were sliding through her hair, playing with her earlobes.
"I hope thee doesn't think I ever did this to any of my brothers," she said, sniffing him with pleasure. "And those of wounded men aren't generally in a condition to be appreciated at all."
Denny cleared his throat and stretched himself a little, not quite squirming.
"I think thee should allow me to appreciate thy own flesh for a bit," he said, "if thee expects me to be able to make thee a wife tonight."
"Oh." She looked down at his cock, and then at herself, surprised.
"What do... does thee mean? Why wouldn't thee be able to?"
"Ah."
He looked pleased and eager. He was so young without his glasses, and bounced off the bed, going into the outer room, his bottom pale and tidy in the candlelight. To Dottie's astonishment, he came back with the book she'd noticed on the table and handed it to her. It was bristling with bookmarks, and as she took it, it fell open in her hands, displaying several drawings of a naked man in cross-section, his private parts in various stages of operation. She looked up at Denny in disbelief.
"I thought... I know thee is a virgin. I didn't want thee to be frightened or unprepared."
He was blushing like a rose, and instead of collapsing in howls of laughter, which she badly wanted to do, she shut the book gently and took his face between her hands.
"Is thee a virgin too, Denny?" she said softly.
His blush grew fierce, but he kept her gaze.
"Yes, but I do know how. I'm a physician."
That was too much, and she did laugh, but in small, half-stifled blurts of giggling, which infected him, and in seconds they were in each other's arms on the bed, shaking silently with occasional snorts and repetitions of,
"I'm a physician,"
which sent them into fresh paroxysms. At last she found herself on her back, breathing heavily, Denny lying on top of her, and a slick of perspiration oiling them. She lifted a hand and touched his chest, and goose flesh rippled over him, the dark hairs of his body curly and bristling. She was trembling, but not with either fear or laughter.
"Is thee ready?"
he whispered.
"One flesh,"
she whispered back. And they were. The candles had burned down nearly to their sockets, and the naked shadows on the wall moved slowly.
"Dorothea!"
"Thee should probably be quiet," she advised him, briefly removing her mouth in order to talk. "I've never done this before. Thee wouldn't want to distract me now, would thee?"
Before he could summon a single word, she had resumed her alarming actions. He groaned. He couldn't help it. And laid his hands gently, helplessly, on her head.
"It's called fellatio. Did thee know that?"
she inquired, pausing momentarily.